Well, I can see that our speaker needs absolutely no introduction whatsoever, but you all seem to know him well. And it is our great delight and pleasure to have Ajahn Brahm with us tonight.
That's me.
He's from Australia to rainy London, and we're very much looking forward to his talk tonight. Just to give you something of his background, he was born in London, North London. He trained as a physicist, a theoretical physicist in Cambridge, taught for a while in a school, in a high school, then went off to Thailand, where he worked with Ajahn Chah, famous and marvellous teacher of great renown, where he wrote a book on the Vinaya, a sort of commentary on the Vinaya, a guide to Vinaya in the English language. Was it in
English that you wrote it?
It was in London language.
So anyway, it was a guide to the Vinaya for people to use, and it is in fact used in a lot of monasteries now. And then he went to Australia, and I'll just read you some of this. Don't get embarrassed.
Okay.
There's a lot of it. Yeah. So currently Ajahn Brahm is the abbot of the Burundiana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia. He's also the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia.
A spiritual dictator.
I know.
He is. I can continue with this. The spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of Victoria, spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of South Australia, spiritual patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, and is currently working with monks and nuns of all Buddhist traditions to establish the Australian Sangha Association. In October 2004, Ajahn Brahm was awarded the John Curtin Medal for his vision, leadership and service to the Australian community by Curtin University. And Ajahn Brahm has also written 3 books, including Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung?, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, The Meditator's Handbook, and Art of Disappearing, Buddha's Path to Lasting Joy. And his latest book is
Ta-da.
Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, Stories of Making the Most of Each Moment.
Thank you
very, very much.
Thank you, very kind of you. So the title of today's talk is Kindfulness, but I probably will speak about something else, I don't know, because you don't plan anything, which is a wonderful thing as a Buddhist, because the Buddha always asks you to stay in the present moment, and don't plan what you're going to do, because if you plan what you're going to do in the future, it means you are not really responsive to what's actually happening now. And even the great Buddhist John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're busy planning something else. So, but about kindfulness, you may all know, those of you who have been looking at the newspapers, that mindfulness is one of these fads which have come in our modern last couple of years in modern society. And even I read even the House of Commons, they had a couple of minutes of mindfulness. It didn't do any good, but at least it's right. And sometimes as a Buddhist monk you think, hang on, you know, we invented that. And I think really that, say, the Buddhist Society in London, you know, this Buddhist Society, you've been here a long time, it's about time you've got a lawyer to sue, you know, all these people in the United States, you know, for intellectual property rights. Imagine that Microsoft or Samsung stole something, you know, from Microsoft, you know, something essential to their operating system. Of course they would sue. And mindfulness is the essential part of Buddhism, and it's been taken away. So, to regain mindfulness for Buddhism, because it's our essential teaching, we're just adding something else which is really important, the kindness. And when you have kindness together with mindfulness, what do you get? Kindness. And I love inventing new words like that, because some of those words actually get into the dictionary. For example, you've heard that, you know, in religion, sometimes when you start to talk about nirvana or the ultimate or emptiness, too many people said that it's ineffable. And you can't really grasp it. You can't really say it with words. It's beyond words, beyond concepts. And that's what the word ineffable means, which to me means bullshit. The Buddha said, those of you who get upset at my language, the Buddha said, this is quoting the Buddha, Ranavibhanga Sutra, and in the Vinaya as well, whenever you teach Buddhism, you should always teach in the local language. So anyway, so now the ineffable. Instead of saying ineffable, I invented a new word called the ineffable. And the ineffable means, whenever you look in the past, and you try to think what you did, and could you have done something different? Because too many people said, if only I'd have done something else, if only I'd have married someone else, if only I'd have accepted that job and not another job. And we spend so much time ifing the past. And I tell you, the past is ineffable. You cannot if the past and say, well, if I did something else, it might have been better. Because you cannot know. It could have been better, it could have been worse, the chances are it would have been perfectly the same. So all those times you if the past, please remember the new word, the past is ineffable. That takes away a lot of problems. But with kindfulness is another word. Actually, one of the other words which is in the dictionary, which is that book, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. Really it should be, one of the stories in that book is Don't Worry, Be Hopi. Because Hopi is now a new word in the English language, which I coined. Because it comes from the common word, don't worry, be happy. And that really sucks. Am I really supposed to be happy all the time? And no, sometimes you can't be happy, and so if you're not happy, you feel guilty. And they have, I don't know, here in London, but in the United States and Australia, some corporations have happiness officers who are always going around making sure you're happy. And if you're not, you get the sack. Or something like that. And it puts really pressure on people to be happy, or they don't feel like being happy, and that's really not good enough. So don't worry, be happy, just add extra stress in life. You feel such a failure if you're not happy all the time. So, because of that, I said, no, look, what is this worry business anyway? Why are you afraid? And it's because you look into the future with a negative mind, looking at all the things which might go wrong in the future. And that's called worry. And you don't need to look in the future with such a negative mind. You can look in the future with the positive mind. You don't know which way it's going to go, but why, if you don't know which way it's going to go, why not, for the sake of your mental health and your happiness here and now, fill the future with hope? You don't know what's going to go happen, but you might as well hope for the best. So that is my saying, don't worry, be hopey. H-O-P-E-Y. And that, someone said that it's in the Urban Dictionary, which is a precursor to going into the Oxford English Dictionary, hopey. So those two words I invented, and the last word is kindfulness, which is a beautiful word, so it adds kindness onto the mindfulness. It's so important. Mindfulness is you're just aware of things. Being aware of things is not enough. Do something about it if you can do something. At least change your attitude to what's happening. And then when you add kindness onto mindfulness, it's amazing the power of that. For example, one of the stories, it's a cheeky example, but I like being cheeky because I was born in London. So I used to come to this place as well a long time ago. And sometimes Desmond was saying, you know, just you come to these places, why do you come to London? You feel like you're coming home again. It is true, you know, you sort of get the smells of London. And ever since I came here, it's been raining. So it's been, oh, such happy memories. I'm back in London, drizzle, grey skies. I don't know if you arranged that on purpose, but ever since I landed, it's supposed to be drizzling and foggy and dark. And anyway, just like I remember it. And I used to come here as well, this is when I was a lay person. In those days I had much more hair. that I know, from one of these long-haired people. And my mother always was telling me, no, my name was Peter. Peter, get your hair cut, get your hair cut. And when I did, she said, that's not what I meant. So in those days, mindfulness was very strong. All the Burmese monks were saying, be mindful. And their mindfulness was actually being aware and noting it. So I developed this very cheeky simile of this very wealthy woman who lived in a big mansion. And she came to the Buddhist Society here in Eccleston Square one evening to listen to a talk. And she told the guard, the gatekeeper of her house, be mindful. There are burglars around. And they know that I may be going out this evening. So I want you to be very mindful so my house does not get locked. And the gatekeeper said, yes, madam, I will be mindful. I've been practicing mindfulness for many years. I'll be very mindful, madam. So she goes and listens to a nice talk in the beautiful Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square. And when she goes back home, she finds her house has been ransacked. The burglars have been in and stolen everything. And she goes to her gatekeeper and says, you stupid gatekeeper, I told you to be mindful. Look, my house has been robbed. And the gatekeeper said, madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking your jewellery out. I noted, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I saw them going in with the truck. Truck going in, I saw the safe going out, I noticed safe going out, safe going out. I was perfectly mindful all the time, lady. Now, of course, such a person would get the sack. Mindfulness is not enough. If there's something to do, you have to do something with it. And one of the most amazing things to do is to be kind. Now, what do we mean by being mindful and being kind? Now please excuse me those who have been following me around, my stalkers, because I said this in a little talk this morning to Hiranti. So, that there's a simple story which I first read as a student and which, again, changed a lot of my attitude towards life. It could have been a Buddhist story, but it was actually written by Leo Tolstoy in a book of short stories. Interestingly, to raise money for the Jewish community over in Russia, who were being discriminated against at that time. And his story was The Emperor's Three Questions, where he envisaged an emperor who had it up to here with organized religion, always fighting each other, cutting off each other's heads, arguing who's right and who's wrong, and even within Buddhism, which is the right type of Buddhism. Is it Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana? Even in Vajrayana, which particular sect is the best one? In Theravada, which is the right one? Is it the forest tradition, the city tradition, the Burmese, the Sri Lankans, the Thais, the Westerners? So confusing, isn't it? And so he said, to hell with all that. I'm going to find my own religion. And it's a very interesting because that is many people's attitudes towards today. You know, religious people have basically lost the plot. They're arguing with each other and fighting with each other, that people actually do not respect religion the same way they did, say, 20, 30 years ago. So he decided, let's find my own religion, get rid of all this extra stuff. And so, thinking, debating, researching, he found all you really need to do in life is to have the answers to these three questions. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what is the most important thing to do? And eventually the story was how he found the answers to those three questions. And that gave him all the religion he needed for his spiritual life as well as his worldly life as an emperor. And those three questions, the three answers. When is the most important time? That's the easy one. When is it?
Now.
Yes, because now is the time your future is being made. Your future is being made right now. So stop worrying about the future. Worry about what you're doing about it now. If you are peaceful, happy, forgiving, kind right now, you are creating a wonderful future for yourself. So we learn, in Buddhism, in life, to pay lots of attention in the place the future is being made. And if you put more attention in this present moment, you're doing the very, very best for your future. And also, what you're doing right now, you'll remember this tomorrow morning. you're also creating your past. The happy memories or the embarrassing memories for tomorrow by what you're doing now. So here, your future and past are being made. This is the only time you can do anything about it. So now it's incredibly important. And the next question, who is the most important person? Who?
The one you're with.
Oh, you give it away. I have much fun with this, because a lot of people say oneself. And that is so egocentric. The one in front of you is the most important person. Now what happens when you're at work? What is the most important thing when you're at work? The job right in front of you. The thing you're doing right now. For me, this talk is the most important thing in the whole world. All the other responsibilities and duties I have, I wait till afterwards. You do one thing at a time, and it's really important. What if it's something unpleasant? You're having an argument. That is important. Don't try and get rid of things. Because a lot of life is teaching you a lesson. We just try and get rid of it. We're not listening to the lesson. We're not learning from it. And even in meditation, sometimes people are sleepy. They want to get rid of the sleepiness. They want to get rid of the restlessness. No, the sleepiness and the restlessness are teaching you something. It's important. Give it value. Stop trying to get rid of things. Because you find your whole life is lived like a pest exterminator. You have many pests in your life. You try to exterminate them. Maybe you've had a husband you didn't like. You've had a committee member you didn't get on with. You have a disease, you know, you don't like. It's amazing how much pest exterminators we are. Because there's many pests in life. We just want to get rid of them instead of learning from them. So if they're right in front of you, they're really important. And give them value. And that changes the whole attitude and the whole experience of life. As many people have noticed, including the Buddha, you can't change life, but you can certainly change your attitude towards it. You can't change people being arguing with you, or being too cold, too hot, getting sick, dying. That's part of life, but you can certainly change your attitude towards it. And the last question is also really, really important. The most important thing to do, you know the story, is to care. And I was just saying this earlier, because there was a nurse here. Many years ago, there was a young man, he'd grown up with me. His parents took him to the temple when he was a small boy, and I saw him go through school, did very well, go to medical school, become a doctor. And the first year as a doctor, as an intern in one of the hospitals, he came to see me. He was devastated. He wanted to give up his whole career and waste all that education because he'd lost his first patient. It was a young woman. Now he was looking after her, she died, and he was the one who had to tell her husband that he had no wife, that his children had no mother. And that was just so hard for him to do that. And even though he'd done the very best, he still felt guilty. He hadn't managed to keep this guy alive. And that was such a hard thing for him to take. He just wanted just to give up the career. He couldn't do that anymore. And that's when I told him, I said, look, you've got the wrong understanding of being a doctor. You think that being a doctor is to cure people. It's not to cure. It's to care for them. If you think being a doctor, or being a nurse, being a psychologist, or even being a monk is to cure everybody, then you'll get frustrated, disappointed, you'll be a failure. A doctor fails many times if they think their job is to cure. But if they understand that their main purpose in life is to care for the person they're with, they never need to fail. Even when their patient dies, they die knowing they've been cared for. What a beautiful experience that is. And the family know that their loved one has been cared for to the max. And that takes away a lot of the grief. Unfortunately, in our modern medical system, curing is more important than caring. Get rid of the disease. Keep them alive at all costs. So have all these expensive, very discomforting interventions when you get close to death. Because we can't allow a person to die. At all costs, we keep them alive. Curing is the priority. Where it should be caring being the priority. Same if you've got a relationship. your partner. Are you trying to cure them? That's the problem with relationships. Try to make them better, make them different, change them. You'll fail and cause a lot of trouble in the meantime. Care for your partner, don't try and cure them. And if you change the attitude to caring rather than curing, it's amazing just how your relationship blossoms. And how you look at the partner and you appreciate them. Don't try and cure your daughter, don't try and cure your mum. Don't try and cure your friends. Care for them. And what that really means is also you'll be having a bit more wisdom in life too. Recently I gave a talk, it's Mental Health Week over in Australia, and so I gave a talk about mental health. And you know, one of the biggest things with mental health is stigma. You know, people will not admit they've got depression, won't admit they've got schizophrenia, they won't admit they have some sort of disorder because of stigma. So I'm trying to make people proud of their mental disorders. And I've given them the simile of the trees and the forest. Because I live in a forest in Australia, and we're supposed to be the forest tradition. So sometimes we buy a bit of land and plant a few trees and think that's a forest tradition. But we actually live in a forest. And I tell people who get depressed, who get upset and angry, I say, please, have a walk in our forest and see if you can find a tree which is dead straight, not leaning to the left or to the right. A tree with all the branches in the right place, with no yellow leaves or brown leaves, only nice green leaves, with no marks or scars on the bark. Find me a perfect tree. And of course they don't even look, because they know that no such tree exists. Every tree in the natural forest is bent and crooked, with brown leaves and yellow leaves and scars, damage on the barks. They are the most beautiful trees in the world. They're the ones I love. So I told people with mental diseases or illnesses, so if you're damaged goods, you belong as a beautiful tree in the natural forest. Welcome. We're all scarred, some more than others. And the ones with the biggest scars, bent all over the place, crooked as hell, they're the ones, the trees I love the best. They are the most beautiful. So if you've got a partner who's all crooked and bent and scarred, change the way you look at them. And then they're really beautiful. Don't try, any one of you who's got a partner who's dead straight with all the branches in the right place, no scars on the bark at all, they're a pain in the neck. They're not real. They're not natural. They're not beautiful. So when you change the attitude like that, you don't need to cure the trees. You don't need to take them and straighten them all up and making sure there's no diseased leaves on there. To get some sander and sand the bark so it's nice and smooth. Fill up all the cracks and the holes. That's a stupid thing to do, but that's what we do with each other. And that's what we do with ourselves. Try and make ourselves perfect. Straighten up all of our faults. I like crooked, I like bent. I don't know about you. So if you've got a husband who's all crooked and bent, you're very lucky. And if you're crooked and bent, if you're damaged goods, well done. And if your meditation's all over the place and crooked and bent, well done. Care for it. Stop trying to cure it. And that's what kindfulness is. You're aware and you're kind to things. And it's incredible how powerful that is as a therapy. Again, I get involved in all of this cutting edge stuff with modern medicine. And so much so that I do get invited to going off to Canada to McGill to do a whole session on neuroscience and Buddhism. I did something in Toronto last time I was there, 2 or 3 years ago. A course on Buddhism, medicine and psychology. And it's a full course for a degree in mental health sciences. You can see just how Buddhism is really giving the goods on what how psychology and also medicine can help. Once it incorporates some of these Buddhist principles. Mindfulness is already in there. I'm trying to bring kindfulness in. because that's even much more potent. Mindful, you're aware of your mental processes, but if you try and cure them rather than care for them, it's hard, it hasn't got any warmth, it hasn't got any power. If you add the kindfulness in there, I'm aware, but I'm kind to who I am. In the first book I said the wonderful story of opening the door of your heart to whoever you are, wherever you've been, whatever's happened to you, bring it in. And that's such a powerful story of kindfulness, because I remember there's a particular group in Perth, Western Australia, where I live, called ASSETS, the Association of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And these are some people who have gone through the worst hell you could possibly imagine. You know that many refugees come to our countries. And actually, just on the by, you know, sometimes the immigration is a very, very hot issue all over the world today. And there was a story in Australia recently, which I think is a beautiful story to share with you. A Vietnamese refugee who came in the 60s, early 70s, in a boat, and he came to the mainland of Australia, in Western Australia, and the first people he saw were two Australians in a fishing boat, who waved at them and said, "Good day, mate, welcome to Australia, have a beer." And there was a traditional Australian welcome. "Good day, mate, welcome to Australia, have a beer." None of this stuff in the immigration. "Where are you? Where you come from? What are you doing here?" It was total acceptance. And this person who said his first experience with Australians when he came as a Vietnamese refugee was about 2 months ago been elected as the governor of South Australia. One of the most prominent positions, the Queen's representative in South Australia. A person who came with nothing, who was welcomed with kindness, and repaid that by giving such a service to business and the community, he's now the head of state for South Australia. It's a wonderful story. He's a Buddhist, Vietnamese. So it's a wonderful, when we welcome people, we get what we give them. We care for them, and things actually get much better. So kindness is a very powerful thing. So for these people who've gone through trauma and torture, now understanding what kindness is, I understood straight away that the big problem with people who have been tortured, the trauma of rape, sexually assaulted, not just once, many times, in these dark dungeons of the world, it's happening right now somewhere, physically tortured, abused, those are such deep wounds inside of people, and much of psychology wants to get rid of those, to cure rather than to care. When I start talking about kindfulness, something clicks. This is who you are. It happened to you. You can't get rid of it. The only thing you can do is open the door of your heart to everything which has occurred to you with who you are, without trying to get rid of anything. Be kind to what has happened. And it's incredible, the result of that. For years I've been trying to get rid of it, and that gives it much more power. When you embrace it, allow it to come in. That's who they are. It wholly changes. It's the attitude you have towards those incredibly painful things. The stigma which you give yourself, which is the major problem. Practice kindness to that. Aware, don't try and hide it, deny it. Bring it in. And I've given many times a simile of the opening the door of your heart to visualize your little heart, like you see on the Valentine's Day cards, because I never did biology, I'll never remember it anyway. I don't know what a real heart looks like. But imagine, you know, a little heart in here somewhere, probably in the wrong place anyway. And imagine two doors open up, a little staircase come out. You know, like in those old aircraft before they had the air bridges? And at the bottom of the staircase, is that person to whom these horrendous things were done. The person has been so abused and hurt. They're standing at the bottom of that staircase. They're being kept out, denied, trying to get rid of, trying to be cured for such a long time. And you're standing at the top there, saying, "Come in. Come in. You're part of me. you can come into my heart as well. And I teach people to imagine these tortured little beings, a little girl who was abused, a little boy who was beaten terribly, coming up into your heart and being embraced. You're part of me. You're who I am. Come inside. The door of my heart is totally open to you. No matter what has ever happened, come in. And once that happens, it's an incredibly powerful transformation. So much so that over in our centre in Perth a few weeks ago, there was one lady who had been through a terrible rape. Really gross. I'm not sort of justifying, you can't justify those things, I would never do something like that. It's an incredible, cruel, heartless, incredibly painful thing to have to endure on all levels. But this lady who'd been raped once, but somebody else said, I said, tell what happened to you. And she scolded them and said, what do you mean a terrible thing which happened to me? That has made me who I am. I am not going to hide that anymore. That is who I am. I've learned, I've grown so much from that. Don't ever you say that. That's a terrible thing which happened to me. I don't want your sympathy anymore. She'd gone past the stigma and the shame. She was through that. An incredibly powerful woman. Wise, kind. That's what can happen with kindfulness. She doesn't try and get rid of things. Embraces them, uses them. And that means you can be transformed. And that's exactly what we use in meditation as well. Doesn't matter what you're experiencing in meditation, be kind to it. Embrace it. Let it come in. Because when you allow things to come in, you're not trying to get rid of things. When you accept them, there's no business to be done. There's nothing you have to get rid of, nothing you have to attain. You're making peace with this moment by allowing it in and being kind to it. Because there's no business to be done, you become peaceful. Because you're peaceful, there's nothing to do. You become still. Because you become still, you become incredibly happy. Because you become very happy, you get insight from the stillness. I often say that if you look at a lake and there's even one little ripple in that lake, you will never see a clear, accurate reflection of the moon and the stars in the heavens at night time. You never see those reflections anywhere in London. But too cloudy. Maybe you do. I think in the summertime it is clear and nice. People tell me that, and I believe them, sort of. But over in Australia it's always clear nights. We have lakes and ponds there. If you look in the lake and there's no waves or ripples in the surface, you see this incredibly accurate, beautiful, perfect reflection of the moon and the stars. Only if the lake is perfectly still. Any ripple distorts the image. And that's the nature of the human mind. Any thought, any movement, any wanting distorts reality. Only through stillness do you see things as they truly are. Do you get wisdom, insight? And the only way you can be still is by being peaceful. The only way you can be peaceful is by having no business. The only way you can have no business is by kindfulness. Being kind. So what you have to do, where you are, what's going on, to embrace it. And then you'll find it's amazing how you can find peace and stillness and wisdom anywhere in this world. Not only in your mind, but in your life. How much of life have you tried to change? And what has happened? It just makes matters worse. And how many times you've been kind and find a little bit of kindness, forgiveness, embracing the people as they are. Realizing they're just crooked trees and the crooked trees are the nice ones. Changing your attitude, and then you find problems are solved. Changing attitudes, becoming wise, kindfulness. But even, I love telling stories about how that affects your body as well. How many times when you have a cancer do you say, get out of here, I don't want you? And it gets worse. How many people, I was they're having the local Cancer Support Association having a grand opening of their new campus next month in November, and I've been looking after this group for such a long time, they've invited me to the grand opening. And they're with the Premier of Western Australia, and they want me to soak him with holy water to try and get some sense into him. He's the head politician. Now I'm going to give a Buddhist blessing. No Anglicans are going, no Catholics, just the Buddhists. And one of the reasons is because even with cancer, you know, there's a right attitude there. And the head of this Cancer Support Association, the last time I saw him, he said to me, "So what do you think about these people who say that they are fighting a battle with cancer?" And I said, "That makes no sense, that's counterproductive, that will not work." And he smiled at me and said, "Yes, thank you, because I've been working in this field for such a long time, and all these people are battling their cancers, fighting it, that makes them so tense, they're the ones who die. People think, I'm going to beat this cancer, I'm going to fight it, I'm going to make a war with it, and I'm going to get rid of it." It's all militaristic language, the sort of stuff which got the cancer in the first place. Amazing. Changing it to a Buddhist attitude. "Cancer, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. Plenty of space in here." What happens then? The kindfulness changes everything. Going back to my early life in Acton. You know, part of Acton is a very nice part, but that wasn't the part I lived in. Because the part I lived in, I never realised at the time, at a school, my school, primary school, was called Derwent Water Primary School, nicknamed Dirty Water. That's kids. And that's the primary school I went to, and there was all immigrants there, Polish, Jamaicans, one Sri Lankan was there as well, I remember. And all these immigrants were there, and I thought that was natural. But I only realise now that if you go to school with lots of immigrants, that's a poor area. That was a poor area. So a lot of time we play soccer in the streets. There's no park available. And whenever you play soccer in the street as a young kid, you know, you'll go for tackles and you always scraping the skin off your knees. And I remember my childhood in Acton, always scraping the skin off my knees and running to my mother in pain, crying. And my mother, not knowing anything about hygiene, she would just kneel down and kiss the wound. All the germs from an open wound, from a mouth, all going into that open wound, it never ever got infected. And in fact, just that little bit of kindness took all the pain away. It stopped hurting. She put a plaster on it and I was playing soccer the next minute or two. That's all it needed, a bit of kindness. And I thought that was normal until I learned a little bit more about science, and now I know how powerful kindness is to heal, to take away pain. And I'm sure every one of you have had those experiences of being in very, very strong pain, and some kind person comes around and they just stroke your hair, or they just look at you with kindness, and it takes it all away. So the therapeutic value of kindness, of compassion, has often been so underrated. So much so that one of my classic stories, I know many of you are here because you see me on YouTube, and many of you here keep saying, "Why do you keep saying the same old stories?" And the reason is because you have the same old problems. So this was this lady, now I can tell her name over here because, you know, she lives over in South Australia, or Sydney now, her name was. She was a young girl, a student, 19 years of age, studying dentistry at Adelaide University, and she got into severe depression and with it anxiety attack. And it was so severe that the local doctor at the university, psychologist, psychiatrist, could help her not at all. She was bedridden, couldn't even get out of her bedroom because of the incredibly severe anxiety. Her luck was her uncle was a strong supporter of mine. So her uncle said, "Give Ajahn Brahm a call." And when she described her symptoms, you know, I knew exactly what to do. Mindfulness, first of all. And so, whenever you have an anxiety attack, where do you feel it in your body? Because I know every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling somewhere in your body. He said, "Well, I don't really know." So I said, "Let me know in 3 days. Give me another call when you can tell me, when you have an anxiety attack, where you feel it in your body." Number one, in any therapy, you have to give people respect. You have to let them take a big part in their therapy. If you just do it all for them, you're taking away their sense of self-respect. But they have to do something. So after 3 days, as a very clever girl, she actually described perfectly exactly where the physical feeling was whenever she had an anxiety attack. So then I said, now describe that feeling to me. She said, well, I can't, it just gets tense, it hurts. So that's not good enough, I want a good description. So call me back in 3 days when you can describe it properly. I was trying to expand her mindfulness to make it more accurate so that she could be really aware of those feelings. I really have a lot of sympathy for doctors, because when patients report to them to say, I've got a pain in my stomach, so what type of pain is it? Well, it just hurts. Poor old doctor, it could be anything, because we don't have enough mindfulness, we haven't developed a language for all the different forms of pain. So poor doctor doesn't know what to do, he has to just guess sometimes. So I asked this lady, young, intelligent, describe it to me. And after 3 days, she rang back and she gave this very detailed, impressive description of all the different feelings which happened when she had a panic attack. And I was so impressed, I said, very well done. Now, third stage, whenever you have one of those panic attacks and you feel it in your body, get your hand and massage it with as much kindness as possible, with compassion. And she was very fortunate, she had a boyfriend who was literally cooking for her, washing all her clothes, because she could do nothing herself. It was like a boyfriend from heaven, one of those rare ones if you find one, marry them quickly before they go away. A wonderful guy, his name was. And so he would sort of wash everything, care for her, and said, so if you can't do it yourself, get to massage you. That's what boyfriends are for. So she followed the instructions, and every time she had a panic attack, she could feel it in her body, and she'd massage it, or massage it for her. And after 3 days, she rang again and said, did you follow the instructions? She said, yes. What happened to the pain, or the feeling in your tummy when you had a panic attack and when you massaged it? She said, oh, it went away. I said, what happened to your anxiety when you did that? I always remember this conversation because she paused. It's what we call light bulb moments. She got it. She said, well, when the physical feeling went away, the panic went away as well. Great, now you know what to do. She never needs to front up anymore. Because every emotion has a corresponding physical feeling in the body. Mindfulness will be able to know that feeling accurately, totally, fully. That's the job of mindfulness. But that's not enough just to know. The next thing is be kind to it, massage it. And you find when the physical feeling responds to kindness and vanishes, its source, the emotion, also diminishes and disappears. Whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, fear, anger, even anger has a feeling somewhere in the body, but we're not mindful enough to know it. Get to know it very, very well. Massage it, give it kindness, and the whole thing unravels. Mindfulness gets to know the problem. Kindness is the care, is the cure. Kindfulness. And it's a very wonderful story, because a couple of years later, actually no, just very quickly afterwards, she was out of bed, went back to university, got first class honours in dentistry, and after graduating, she married and I did the ceremony for her. Really cute. And of course they're really strong disciples, and she said, I saved her life, and I did. Simple thing, like kindfulness. And I've done that. There was a doctor, you know, Mukta in Perth, he's one of our committee members. You know, she was looking after someone with anxiety, who had such strong anxiety that she had to be on oxygen all the time because she couldn't breathe properly. And she had tried in one of the big public hospitals every medication on the book. Because that's what doctors do. Try this one, if that doesn't work, give some other pill, some other injection. Until she'd run out of medication to give this girl. And it was late in the afternoon, she didn't know what to do next, so she tried out some Brown's medication. Say, well, whenever you get anxiety, feel it in your body and massage it. When she went to work the next day, she said, the oxygen mask was off. She said, I feel great now, I'm going home. She should have tried that in the first place instead of all these other medications. It actually works. Kindness is incredibly powerful. Adding the kindness, compassion to mindfulness, whether it's your health, whether it's trauma,
whether it's problems in your marriage, try kindfulness. Be aware, be kind to the people you live with, instead of always seeing just what's wrong with them. Don't try and cure. Be kind to the people you live with. What's it like when someone doesn't want to change you? They're not trying to cure you and get rid of you. They say, well, I know we're all imperfect, but I accept you for who you are. If you had a person like that come into your life, if you have, then you're incredibly lucky. But don't try, they appreciate, respect you as you are. It's one of the things which people need most of all, respect. Don't want to change. You know, you're trying to do the best you can. We're not perfect. You accept people, you care for them. Isn't that what you would like? To be understood? You're not perfect. As for me, I tell terrible jokes. I always. My latest terrible joke, you haven't heard this because it's a new one. It's, you know, the many years ago, the Indian tribes over in the west of the United States, one of the most famous of those was the Comanches. And the leader of the Comanches at one time was this Indian warrior called Cochise. And when Cochise was his name, of the Comanche Indian tribe. When Cochise was getting very old, you know, he said, "It's only a little time and I will be going to the happy hunting ground. So I have to choose a successor." So he called into his tent two of his fiercest, strongest, wisest of braves. Geronimo was one of them. He's famous now. You all know Geronimo. But the other one was an Indian called Falling Rocks. And he brought them both into the tent and said, "Now I've chosen you two as the fiercest. One of you will become the head of Comanche Nation, the chief. But I can't decide between you, so I have to give you a test. I want you to go out into the plains for 30 days and capture as many buffalo and skin them. Whoever comes back with the most buffalo skins will be the chief of the Comanche tribe." So they both go separate ways. After 30 days, Geronimo comes in with many, many, over 100 buffalo skins. But as for Fallen Rocks, he never comes back. And it's part of the culture of those tribes. They never abandoned any one of their men. They sent search parties out to try and find him. And they never gave up searching for Fallen Rocks. In fact, even today, they're still looking for him. We know that because in the Indian territory there you see all these signs: "Watch out for Fallen Rocks." Now you're all shaking your head. You're all saying that's a terrible joke. I guarantee you will tell your friends tomorrow. Inflict pain. That's who I am, you know that. I can't change that. You accept yourself as you are. And so when you accept yourself as you are and you have kindness, the whole problem disappears. And it's not only just solving the problems in life, it's solving the problems in your meditation, your spiritual life as well. So don't try and change the Muslims. Care for them. That's powerful, isn't it? Kindness. Even on a national scale, international scale. See what would happen. Anyway, that's the talk. Now questions. Okay. Any questions, comments, complaints?
I already knew the joke.
You already knew the joke. Okay. Well, you've been watching me for too long, following me around. When did I tell you? On the phone. Okay. Very good. Teddy jokes. Very good, yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
At the very end of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness.
Yes, yes, yes.
Satipara Sutta.
Yes.
The Buddha says, if any person practices this for a week, they shall expect full knowledge or become knowledge now.
Yes.
Why doesn't that keep happening?
Have you ever brought, say, a microwave?
Sorry?
Have you ever bought a microwave or a computer?
No.
And you read these, well, you bought something, but a car. You bought a car.
No, I bought a car either.
And a house?
No.
Washing machine.
Washing machine. Okay, you bought something in life. Anyway, you bought something and you read the instructions and it doesn't work. You know, a lot of times when you do that, there's nothing wrong with the machine. You've misunderstood the instructions.
Yes, but the same was rather large. You can't all misunderstood it.
Ah, a lot of them do. If you read the Satipatthana, the thing they don't understand there is the phrase Vivicheva. I'm not sorry, that's Jhanas. It's was it Abhijja Dhammanasa? Vinaya, that's right. Vinaya loke Abhijja Dhammanasa. It's a Pali phrase which means, Vinaya means having abandoned, having let go of, having surpassed. Loke Abhijja Dhammanasa. Now, if you read English translations of the Satipatthana, the most common translation, having abandoned greed and covetousness for the world.
Yes.
Now, what the hell does that mean?
Well,
it says repeatedly, but if you read it in Pali, the first time I started reading these sutras in Pali, I came across those words, Loke Abhijja and Dhammanasa, many, many times. Loke Abhijja is a synonym for the first hindrance, Kamachanda. When they talk about the five hindrances, the Panchanivarana, most of the time, maybe 60% of the time, they use the word Kamachanda. The other 40% of the time, many times they use Loke Abhijja. Dhammanasa, twice in the suttas, is a synonym for the second hindrance, Vyapada. Now that's what I saw, then I checked in the commentaries to the Satipatthana Sutras. There's two, there's Mahasatipatthana Sutra in the Digha Nikaya and the Satipatthana Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. In both of those commentaries, they too say Vinaya Loke Abhijja Dhammanasa means having abandoned the first two hindrances. And they say it is the idiom of Pali. If you mention the first two of a group, the other members of that group are inferred. Commentaries say this means having abandoned the five hindrances. If you abandon the five hindrances first, and then you do Satipatthana for 7 days, then it works. The problem is that people don't abandon the five hindrances. They haven't read the instructions and understood them. That's why it doesn't work. Because remember, people say Satipatthana Sutta, but you read the whole of the suttas. The way to become enlightened is always Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. Not just the seventh path of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha was very compassionate and wise. If there was a shortcut, he would have told us. And he said, no, you need all eight factors. You need your morality as well. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If that's not there, you're not going to be able to get enlightened. You need your right view. And second factor is my favourite one. The right intention. Samasankapa. There's three right intentions. First one is Nekamasankapa, called renunciation, otherwise known as letting go. This whole thoughts of letting go. And so many people, if they meditate trying to get something. I'm going to get jhanas. I'm going to get enlightened. I'm going to get psychic powers. Ajahn Chah said again and again and again, we meditate not to get things, not to attain. You meditate to let go. So having that whole idea when you meditate, you're not trying to get to the next stage. You're trying to let go of things. Abandon. The next one, Avayapada Sankapa, which means metta, loving kindness. Meditating with kindness. I was telling someone, I was in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, staying at a temple with monks from all over the place, and there was a monk from mainland China visiting. And at breakfast he was telling me some gossip about what's happening in China. And there was one Zen master in China teaching a retreat, and he was using the stick. And there was one middle-aged woman was nodding during the retreat, so he hit her on the back with a stick. She got out her mobile phone, called the police, and the monk was arrested. True. You can't do that these days. Be careful. If you allow someone like that to happen in the Buddhist society, you get us soon as well, Desmond. Occupational health and safety. So the whole thing doesn't make any sense to me. Why you have to do that? Is where's the compassion of Buddhism gone? So this is the second factor, the Eightfold Path. Right intention is letting go, kindness, and the last one, ahimsaka sankappa. We know that word from Mahatma Gandhi, ahimsa, non-violence. So that is core number two of the Eightfold Path. Thoughts of letting go, kindness and gentleness. And sometimes monks forget that. You know, some people go to some retreats, it's so cruel. Get up, sit up, don't say anything. Now, walk, now, sit. I don't know why you guys allow that to be done to you. There's also, there's something basically wrong there. There's no kindness there. So, this is an important part of the Eightfold Path. And of course then you've got the morality, right speech, action, livelihood. Now the effort part, now that's the most fascinating one. It's the effort to say no, to stop. The effort to renounce. Not the effort to get things. It's an effort which goes in the totally opposite direction. And then you've got the mindfulness, the satipatthana, as you say. And the last factor, those of you who have heard me again and again, please, please, please never call that right concentration. It's got nothing to do with concentration, it's right stillness, samadhi. Concentration gives the wrong message. Concentration is what you have to do at school. Concentrate, girl! And if you go on a meditation retreat, it becomes a concentration camp. And many of them are like that. Then there's something wrong there, it's stillness. And when you think like stillness, I said the still pool, which has a perfect reflection of the moon and stars, that is accurate Pali. Remember, I teach that for such a long time. A professor from MIT, who's from China, she's now got tenure at MIT in, I think, economics. She was actually telling me, said, we all know that, because in the Chinese version of the sutras, the last factor of the Eightfold Path is always translated as right stillness. Nothing to do with concentration in the Chinese. The Chinese scholars who took Buddhism to that great country, they learnt Pali or Sanskrit, and they translated that word always as stillness. They got it right. English, we've got it a bit wrong. It changes the whole idea of meditation when it's stillness, not concentration. So, I expanded that a bit, but does that answer your question? It doesn't. That's right, because we don't have enough stillness. We don't abandon the five hindrances, because the only way to abandon the five hindrances is getting the mind perfectly still. Jhanas.
The five hindrances are just an elaboration of the road against the mind.
Yeah, indeed. And lobha is especially wanting something. So the people who do satipatthana, wanting to get enlightened, have forgotten the instructions. You don't want anything. All wanting is a hindrance. It's lobha. Craving. That's why people don't get enlightened.
Psalm 46, line 10. Be still and know.
That thou art God, yeah, the ultimate. Exactly, be still. So whenever you want something, you create more waves in the mind. That's why all the teachers from all the traditions, the big word is let go. They say, but I'm trying to let go. Come on, let go. That's not letting go, that's wanting to let go. That's why it's such a difficult thing to do. Until one gets the message, and lets go of wanting. And stops wanting to let go. When you understand the difference between wanting to let go and letting go of wanting, then you're still. When you're still, satipatthana for 7 days actually works. But it's very hard to stop the habit of wanting something. You know why? We're going into the deep stuff now, I don't mind. Because wanting is what your sense of ego and self does. That's its job, to control things in the world. So to let go of control is letting go of your sense of who you are. Letting go of the self. That's why when I was at Cambridge on the philosophy department walls at the time, I saw this with my own eyes. They had graffiti. In those days, graffiti was very funny and very profound. And this was philosophy department, and the first line was, to do is to be. And that was René Descartes. And underneath, they've written about Jean-Paul Sartre, the other way around. Not to do is to be is to do.
Yeah.
And underneath that, the third line, summed it all up, the modern American philosopher, Frank Sinatra, yeah, doobie doobie doo.
That's funny, the first two or three times you hear it.
Yes, I know, but it actually tells you that why is it only funny the first couple of times? Why is it only funny the first couple of times? Why is it only funny the first couple of times? Isn't sort of, say the Tchaikovsky's 1812, doesn't it move you every time you hear it? When you see a sunset, I've seen sunsets many times. They're always beautiful. Yeah, well, no, it was after the French army. Let's think about that. But what it actually does, sometimes the sense of self. This is interesting. Why people laugh while they don't laugh? I've sometimes told a really funny joke, and people they stay there and they refuse to laugh because of the idea of I am much better than that. It is, it's ego. I say, come on, laugh, it's good fun. Even your favourite jokes. When I've told that joke many more times than you've heard it. And I enjoy telling it.
Living in the moment.
In the moment, yeah. But letting go of the past. But the most important thing is that it's the ego, the sense of self, is what does things. And when you stop doing things, your sense of being vanishes. Which is one of the reasons why it's the hardest thing to let go and do nothing, because your sense of who you are starts to vanish and disappear. And it gets scary to let go. Psychologically, spiritually, you are vanishing. Your sense of who you are, your sense of self. You're getting closer and closer to what the Buddha said about non-self, anatta. Every time there's a bit of self left, you'll always be doing something. Because that's what a self is. So what its function is. Come on, I love arguments. They're really fascinating. You know when you get these debates between people and they agree with each other, that's really boring. But when somebody actually gets going, because we have a really good, okay, you know. Okay, any other question? Yes? Yeah. Hi.
Can I just say how exciting it is to be here, and that I'm a YouTube fan, and
yes.
I've been in Buddhism for about a year, so
yeah.
My knowledge is really tiny. But one thing that I'm really stuck with is you were talking on YouTube about the lotus flower, symbol of us,
yeah.
And open everything up and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
So if the sense of ourself is a delusion, what's reincarnated?
What's reincarnated? It's a process. Imagine, I use a mango because I live in a sort of warm country. Imagine let's say an apple, because you live in England. You eat a beautiful apple, a really delicious apple, and you know, you take one of the seeds, you plant it in your garden. And that little seed starts to sprout, and your little green shoot comes up, and you care for it, guard it, and it grows into a small little sapling, and the sapling grows bigger and bigger. And one day, the first flowers come out, they get pollinated, and the first fruit comes, and you eat the new apple. What went across from the first apple to the new apple? There's not probably any, the DNA has changed as well, it always mutates slightly. And all the chemicals which were in the first apple, probably not in the second apple, what went across? Nothing actually got reincarnated from the first apple to the new apple. But there was a connection, every stage of that process, you can see. You can see the seed, you can see the seed split, this little green shoot come up, pushing every day closer to the surface. You can see it push through the surface, you can see it get bigger and bigger every day. You can see it, you know, get wooden at the stem. You can see it sort of start to branch out. See it actually put forth many, many new branches. It's becoming a tree. Every day you can see it grow. And you see the first flower which comes out. And then at the base of the flower it just starts to swell. That's the apple. And you can see it grow day after day, green, green, and then it starts to ripen and get red, and then you pluck it and eat it. There's a connection between every part of that process, but nothing goes across. That's the same with reincarnation. There's a connection every day. There's a connection between who you were yesterday and who you are today. But you're totally different, nothing's gone across. That's like reincarnation. The idea there has to be a being, a person, something which gets reincarnated. There's another way of looking at it. That makes no sense. But the whole process, one thing leading to another, leading to another, leading to another. And that's you, that's your life. Yes?
Jaman, in that case, I mean, what is it that remembers?
What it is it remembers is...
I mean, you can have past life recollection.
Oh, past life recollection. Now, that's fascinating.
You know,
that is the same process, because I was a physicist, the same process as with gravity. You know the moon and the earth, they attract each other. The sun attracts. And it takes, was it 8 minutes for the information to get from the sun to the earth? But how did it get across? Many scientists have been looking for gravity waves or particles, gravitons, messengers which take the information from the sun to the earth, which is called the gravity. To this day, no one has ever found a gravity wave or a graviton. No scientist knows how gravity works. But the evidence there, it does work. The same as memory. There are two types of memory. There's the memory of the last time you remembered something, which is the usual memory we have, which is why over the years the memory gets distorted. It's the old game of Chinese whispers. At school, remember those people who played Chinese whispers? You stand in the line, the teacher said to the first kid something, and they repeated the next. By the time it gets to the end, it's totally different. And a great example of that was in the First World War, where the general gave the order, send reinforcements, we are going to advance. And that was given to who's the next one down, the colonel. The colonel told it to the major told it to the lieutenant told it to the captain told it to the sergeant told it to the corporal, who told the soldiers, send 3 and 4 pence, we're going to advance. That actually happened in the First World War. You know, because the orders went down the chain of command, it was Chinese whispers in real life. And send reinforcements, we're going to advance, became send, you know, the old British money, 3 and 4 pence, we're going to advance. That's how your memory works. For most of you, you remember the last time you remembered it. And every time it changes slightly, which is why what you remembered of your childhood probably never happened. Why I argue with my brother about what happened. We were both there at the time, we were both totally convinced we're right. But we understand the whole process of memory. Every time you remember it, you remember the last time you remembered it. It's the Chinese whispers, and it changes every time slightly. And after many years, it's totally different. The other way of memory is the old action at the distance. This is the stuff you get in meditation. Maybe that's the only way you can say it happens, because otherwise there's no way you can actually say that. How on earth can you remember past lives? But people do remember past lives. Real past lives. And that has actually been proven. Basically, I was a scientist and know the criteria and the proof. Unfortunately, I have a saying these days, extraordinary statements need extraordinary proof. Basically, they change the goalposts when it's something which challenges their basic beliefs. Anything else in science, I always say the Higgs boson, the God particle, which, you know, people have won Nobel Prizes for that. They've only found maybe evidence of one. You can never see a Higgs boson, You see effects which you work back and say, well, maybe that was a Higgs boson. But imagine how many egos, how many literally billions of dollars have gone into that process, that the program in CERN. How many huge scientific egos have been involved in that. If they didn't find one, now your taxpayer dollars, billions, I mean much more than if they buy some sort of new jet for the British Air Force, have been wasted. It's amazing how much money you pay for science, for research. No one questions that. But there's the Higgs boson. It's got very little evidence, basically. I'm a scientist, a theoretical physicist. It's a maybe. They may have found one. One, that's all. The evidence requirements are very low. The evidential requirements for reincarnation are impossible. They raise the bar so high because they don't want to believe it. And that's the problem. It's really unfair. If they use the same criteria for proof they use it everywhere else in science, every scientist would have to accept reincarnation exists. There's too much evidence to prove it. Too many people can remember their past lives. And there's no other way of explaining it. And that is action at a distance. And the whole idea of time. Okay, sorry, yeah, go on.
Yes, I'm a complete novice.
Yeah.
My husband.
Excellent. He dragged you here.
I'm rather confused. Didn't you say earlier on to this lady that reincarnation is only the process?
It's a process.
The example of the seed.
Yes.
So
but
now we're talking about reincarnation in the proper sense with past lives.
Oh, past lives is there too.
I'm confused.
There was an apple in the past. There was
apple that grows from the seed.
But they can connect with one another.
Through the process.
Through the, no, just bypassing the process.
Mm-hmm.
Direct contact with the past. This is the same, I said, Lord Gandhi, this no messenger takes the information, you know, from distant stars, you know, to planet Earth. The gravity exists, we know that. There's no messenger takes the information from your previous life. But you can trace it, you know, every day, every year, every century, you can see the information being stored somewhere. The information is not stored. You can just connect with the past, with nothing in between. Now, a lot of trouble with science is that we are limited by our imagination. And I was a quantum physicist, and quantum science is brilliant because it totally challenges your framework for views, the way you look at this universe. And recently I've been talking about time to people. Because in many religions, we always ask, where did the universe begin? And even if you are a theist and believe it was created by a god, that doesn't answer the question. Because then you say, well, what created the god? If you're a physicist and you say, Big Bang, well, what was there before the Big Bang? It still doesn't answer the questions. But Buddhism can answer those questions very easily. And the way to answer that is the idea of, when I was a young kid, I remember going to school, and I was saying this morning, if there was no pretty girls on the bus, I would think about all sorts of interesting stuff. It's a beautiful girl, and then you wouldn't think about anything else except young man. So sometimes I would be looking through the window just thinking of, you know, where does this universe end? And how can it end? If there's an edge to this universe, is there like a brick wall there, saying by government orders you can't go any further? Or like, you know, is it to just drop away? And if it drops away, where does it drop away to? Is there some razor wire fence? End of the universe, not allowed to go further? It doesn't make any sense. Trying to contemplate, how can a universe have an end to it? But we all know that this universe is finite space. There's a very beautiful, very simple mathematical argument which actually proves it cannot go on forever. But the I started thinking about that a lot, and the answer came when I was doing physics at university. Now they said this universe is a finite space. We know how big this universe is. It doesn't go on forever. It's got no edges to it. And the explanation was, imagine an ant crawling on a soccer ball. The ant goes round and round and soon finds out the soccer ball's only got a finite area. Sooner or later it gets stuck on where it's been before. He knows it's a finite area, but the soccer ball has got no beginning or end. There's no edges to it. And that was the explanation I was given at Cambridge for how to contemplate this great universe in which we live. It's like a soccer ball in another dimension. No beginning, no end, but a finite space. And that is accepted as basically scientific truth. Now, why can't we apply the same to time? Finite duration, but no beginning and no end. Just like the soccer ball, you can go round and round. You can't find an edge. No beginning, no end. Once you can get your head around that, bye-bye God. Bye-bye Big Bang. Don't need anything. Big Bang is just one part of this great cycle of universes. And that's a very beautiful concept because it answers all the problems. The universe cannot have a beginning. Time can't have a beginning. Time can't have an end. Just like the football. And the ant looking for the beginning and the end never finds it. Why? Because it's never there. Our problem is because the way we look at the world has not been expanded enough. Just like ancestors, you may laugh at them, but they couldn't even conceive this planet Earth as anything else but flat. I don't think they were stupid. That's just the limits of their perception at the time. That's all they could see. Now, we've expanded, but not far enough. We can sort of get the fact this planet Earth is spherical, but very few people can still get the fact this universe is curved too. And even less can get the fact that time is finite, but has no edges. And few people get that you can connect to the past with nothing in between. Like wormholes in space. If you look at theoretical physics, a place here, you get a wormhole in space, basically you can go from here to the other edge of the galaxy in no time at all. Connect with something which is far distant in space. Connect with something which is far distant in time. The answers are, or the problem is, our imagination, the way we conceive of things is not expanded enough. It's just too limited. When you expand your way of looking at time and space, then you can understand reincarnation. You can connect. And people do. Even recently, one of the fellows, actually another fellow in Perth, this fellow in Perth, he went to one of these hypnotic regression people, and he only went there because his brother was having psychological problems. The therapist wasn't able to help, so he heard that if you go through hypnotic regression, sometimes you get some experience from a past life. It may not even be a real past life. They have some experience, and once they experience that, there's a catharsis, and the problem is lessened or even solved. You can read about that in books on the internet. Hypnotic regression actually works. Whether it's a past life or not, let's leave that open for a while. So this person, he went to one of the therapists, actually Dennis Shepherd, you know him, just to see, to test it out before he advised his brother. And this guy, he was in the SAS, Special Air Services. He'd just gone on an exercise, you know, a terrorist exercise in Perth. He was actually in the reserves, so he was a very fit man and very down to earth. And, you know, he was a bit exhausted when he finished his exercise. And he went to the therapist. And he said that was probably one of the reasons why he was just so, all his defences were down because of exhaustion, why the very first time he got a memory from his previous life, which really shocked him. The first time was very rare. It had details as well. And it was working with emotions. The emotions were the key, you know, how he felt. And once he got that feeling, the emotion of past life, then the therapist asked the question, what was your name? Where were you? What were you seeing? And he described this time in Fremantle, about 100 years ago, and something I never knew, that there was a class of military whose only job was to look after the convicts. And they were special uniform. He was looking at the red shirts, the ordinary British soldiers of the time, which actually did wear red shirts at that time. He was wearing a brown uniform. And the British government at the time were employing his people and saying he spent 3 years looking after the convicts, which was not a very nice job. And after 3 years, we'll give you land in the new colony of Western Australia. And he was from Ireland, had no prospects in life, and even though he's Irish, and which they hated the Brits, and he said, but he put aside his politics because this was a way to get out of poverty, to go to a new land, start over again. So he signed up, and this is what he actually did. He remembered all of this. I didn't know this, but it's actually true. They've got records, they've got photos of these people. And he remembered meeting his wife in a pub over in Fremantle. And these are the things he remembered. He remembers her name. But interestingly, that the therapist only asked the first names, what's your name? And he gave the names and never said the surname. And so he went into the library, you know, looking through the marriage records at the time. He remembered the church, he remembered everything. And there was two people by that Christian name at the same time. He knew what his wife did, where she came from, where he came from, and it was them. That's how he found out his surname. Everything else matched. And he remembered just once he finished going to get a grant of land in the south of Western Australia, building her first stone house. He went there, you know, with Dennis to find this place. When he asked the farmer, he said, yeah, there was an old house there. And he went there, that wasn't it. He said, no, this is the wrong place. And you know, he knew where it was because he could recognise the scene. He says, up on the hill over there. And even the farmer didn't realise, you know, he saw the old stones up there. Actually, the farmer did realise, but never said, because the farmer had demolished that house because it was in the wrong place, and that was against the law. This was heritage, listed property. So the guy knew what the farmer had been up to. All of this actually matched. And interestingly, this guy, he wasn't much of a Buddhist before, but now he says, I've got to keep my five precepts now. I like a bit of beer and every now and again a while. I can't do that anymore. And that was an interesting byproduct of this. Once he remembered, you know, this Australian guy, you know, businessman, not at all a person you think is weird. And you know, he remembers his past life and he said, I've got no choice. I have to keep these five precepts because with the memory of his past lives, he knows what's really important, what's not. Being a good person, being a kind person becomes so important. That's an interesting aspect if you do remember your past lives and you do accept it as true. Some of the other teachings of Buddhism, like your morality, your kindness, your service, become really, really important. You have to serve. You can't be selfish anymore once you know how the system works. And that's one of the reasons why, as a Buddhist monk, really pushing for people to understand reincarnation and to accept it. You know, it was part of the Christian church until Pope Vigilius, I think it was 6th century sometime. The Pope Vigilius was asked by an emperor called Justinian to actually declare reincarnation anathema, a heresy in the church. The Pope refused. The Emperor Justinian put the Pope in jail. This is historical fact, for over a year, until the Pope recanted. And afterwards, he was released from jail, they held a meeting, and they voted, surprise, surprise, to make reincarnation a heresy in the church at the time. It wasn't actually the Pope's fault, it was the Emperor's fault. They decided it was not going to be acceptable, and they made it unacceptable, and it's been so since that time in the Christian church. There's just too many people who remember their past lives. Sometimes they're your children. Yeah.
The problem with reincarnation is a lot of people interpret it as being a self that goes from life to life.
Exactly. If you take it to be a self, then it becomes yourself. So in essence it's not, but many people believe it is, because that's how they interpret the world. So there is a self there, if you think there is. You make it. That's who you think you are. Even your past in this life. Sometimes if you don't know how to let go of that past, you know, say you've gone to jail. You know, you think you're a criminal, you think you're a bad person. You don't need to do that. We become prisoners of our past. We don't know how to let go. And that's past lives too. which is one of the reasons why when you get the regression therapy, you bring up that past life, then you can let it go. And the problem you have in this life disappears with it.
That may be the best way to go up past life experiences, because doesn't the mind have to be quite strong and ready enough to put the crossfire, enough to feel able to kind of process?
Well, I think some people are, their backs against the wall.
Mm.
They have some emotional, psychological problems which are not able to be treated in other ways. So as a last resort they go to these people. One of the other great stories, this was from a therapist over in Sydney. There was a young girl who was anorexic. She was about 16 years of age. And no doctor or psychiatrist could help her. She was dying. And so, no, she was not strong at all. And her mother took her to see this regression therapist. That was the last throw of the dice. She was, didn't know what else to do. And it happened that this girl was easy to hypnotize and regress. And she got a past life in the first session as a younger sister, many years ago. And both her and her elder sister fell in love with the same guy. And her elder sister was more beautiful, and she, the younger sister, was plain. Boys being boys, the boy chose the elder sister and married her. And she was so heartbroken, she killed herself. She committed suicide. And that was the reason why in this life she was trying desperately to be pretty, because it caused her such suffering in her previous life that lost her the man she loved. But the strange part of this, which also shows how karma and reincarnation works, the strange part of this, while this was being said under hypnosis, the mother was in attendance to make sure nothing untoward happened to her young 16-year-old daughter, and she became hysterical. And the therapist had to calm the mother down. And when she calmed down, "Why were you getting so hysterical like that?" And she said, "I was that sister. I never told my daughter what had happened to her auntie, because we were ashamed of it. Now my younger sister and I fell in love with the same guy. I married her. My younger sister, she told me she was heartbroken and killed herself. She's been reborn as a man she loved, daughter. That's as close as she could get to her, to him rather. That is my sister from a previous life now." Just like it says in the suttas, we tend to actually attract each other and come back into similar relationships. Which is, I've seen that too many times. You know, that is your husband sitting next to you.
Yeah.
Why did you marry him and no one else? How many people, it's strange, how many people have love at first sight? There we go. You know, this weird couple, they came to the retreat which I was giving. Now, they're supposed to be keeping all these precepts, but they're always sitting next to each other in meditation hall, holding hands. But I accepted that when they told me what had happened. She was Russian, I think he was Dutch. And I think they met in some weird place, you know, like I think Iraq or somewhere. They met each other at some function. And she, never seen him before in his life, went right up to him and said, "Your name is Stephen and I'm going to marry you." I know, just imagine, you're a guy, and this girl comes up to you and they know your name, they've never met you before, and say, "I'm going to marry you." And of course they did. Now, something from past life, she recognized him immediately, knew his name, and knew that this was the guy I'm going to be with. And he knew it too. And it's incredible how, even with all the precepts, and being in retreat centers, with all those precepts, there's no way you keep them apart. I can't fight karma. Why does that happen? That is past lives. That's why you meet, and you're not meeting someone new. It's, here we go again. That's what it feels like. What other explanation could there be? Oh, I'm finishing off now. Okay, great fun. So, thank you.
Here we've got time for one more question.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah?
Yes, go on.
Martin Brown, firstly, thank you.
Okay, there you go, now you can go.
I have a very prosaic question, very day-to-day question.
Okay.
We get inspired by Dharma and Buddhism, and how do we stop ourselves from being a pain in the neck and imposing our art on our friends and family around us?
Okay. When I became a monk, I was sending all these letters back to my mother in Acton, saying how wonderful Buddhism is, and trying to explain her the incredible, profound teachings of the Buddha. And then one day I wrote her a letter, asked her, all this letter I sent you about Buddhism, how much do you understand? She wrote back saying, nothing. Start trying to convert other people to your wonderful views, because then you do become a pain in the neck. Instead of conveying the teachings to other people, convey the heart of the teachings. Be someone who's very kind, non-judgmental. You can see people with faults like beautiful scarred trees. You can embrace people even if they sort of act improperly. There must be a reason for that. They must be having a terrible day today. And be kind to people, be peaceful to people. Because, you know, whoever is right in front of you, they're important. Most important person in the world. Don't try and get rid of them. Now is the most important time, so if you want to say to someone how much you love them and care for them, do it now. They may not be around tomorrow. That's the most important thing to do, is to care. If you take the heart of Buddhism and convey that, you're never a pain in the neck to anyone. And most importantly, you're never a pain in the neck to yourself. Thank you. Very good.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Take the mic.
Yeah, can I just say that well, thank you so much for coming, first of all.
Anytime.
A wonderful talk. Really.
Anytime I'm passing by the Northern Hemisphere.
I'll keep you to that, yeah. We will keep you to that. And just to say that on the 23rd of November, Professor Carol Werner
still
is talking about yoga and Buddhism. So please do come. The other thing is that on your way out, there's a begging bowl, and that's for the electric lights and all the other things here. So please don't forget to put something in. But just to say once again, thank you very, very much. And I hope we take back some of the wonderful things you've told us and practice them.
Very good. Please take back the jokes.